welcome to Critical Thinking for Everyone!
Wow! Listen up, this is your favorite critical thinking duo.
These are they.
Yes.
We are them.
We are. This is Patty Payette.
And Brian Barnes.
And together we are Critical Thinking for Every.
What? Everyone!
That's right. Instead of a crime-fighting duo, we're a critical thinking duo.
Well, we're here to maybe bam out, bop out, bip out, zonk out some of those bad ideas. I don't know all the sound effect noises anymore.
Yeah, that would be fun if you could put those in during the editing.
Yeah,
just make them up. We are here because we are all about critical thinking, and we hope you are listening to the show intentionally because you want to hear about critical thinking.
Oh, yeah. If you're not, this is going to go quick. I think you're probably going to switch that dial. And if you, and also, we hope, you know, you're not a hostage or something. I mean, if so, just please blink twice and we'll send help.
We hope we'll win you over with our winning critical thinking ways.
Woo! Yes. A joke or two along the way.
That's right. And we are have some actually business. We need some fun business to attend to.
Business.
Yeah.
What's our business?
It is the end of April 2024.
Uh-oh.
And we need to give a big thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, because we met our fundraising pledge drive goal.
Yeah.
75, or what am I saying? 75? No, it was
$75. We appreciate everyone's generosity at this very emotional time.
No, it was $7,000.
$7,000. That's a little more correct.
Yeah.
Just, not that anything's wrong with 75.
Yeah. In celebration of our 7th birthday.
Yeah.
At the beginning of April, we had a pledge drive, and we want to thank every single one of you who pledged money, who kept us on, you know, kept us going for another year.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just thought about giving and you didn't give, you can, guess what? You could still give.
And we want to thank you, too, just for thinking of us. We think that that's really nice.
The thought that counts.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's worth something. Maybe that thought will eventually turn into action on your part, and you'll go to forwardradio.org and click that give button.
Yeah, or is, no, donate button.
It's a different word for give.
Donate
button.
Donate give. Anyway, we are just so tickled that we met our goal.
It was nice. And we did a live show.
We did a live show begging people to call.
We got a really nice donation from Arthur Street Hotel.
Yes.
Which helps with the housing, houseless issues here in Louisville, and is a social justice treasure. So really grateful for $100 from Donnie over there.
Yeah. So anyway, so that means we're going to be on the air for another year, which means Brian and I are going to be bringing this critical thinking stuff at you.
For another year.
Brian, how are we going to come up with stuff to talk about?
Well, there's so many things we haven't talked about yet.
Really?
I mean, it's endless.
Really?
Yeah.
So. Name one thing we haven't talked about.
We have not talked about the most recently published critical thinking books.
Okay, true. You got me on that one.
Ever.
Well, no.
I mean, we've talked about critical thinking books.
A couple years ago, in January, we did a show about books that were recently published. Mm. But we didn't really do a deep dive. So, okay.
I just think we're not keeping up with the state of affairs.
Yeah.
Did you hear the recent news about university tuition?
No.
A threshold has been crossed.
What is that?
This is worth talking about. I think one university in the United States in fall will charge $100,000 per year.
What?
For the first time.
Is it an Ivy League?
It is not.
It's not an Ivy League?
It is regional to us.
What? No. No.
Who's the snootiest school around here?
Snootiest school around
Just go in a circle. Just go in a circle around.
Duke?
That's a little far. Oh, a little far away.
Vanderbilt?
It's Vanderbilt. $100,000 a year to go to college in Tennessee.
Oh, my gosh.
Are you kidding?
Wow. Wow.
I wonder if that kind of stuff makes people happy. I wonder if you get... If you pay more for college, if your college experience is happier.
Well, you know, it's a good question, Brian, because today, listeners, our show is about happiness.
It's a good question in the show.
And it's a good question because if I was a parent, at $100,000 tuition per year.
Bruh.
That would make me not happy. Mm-hmm. Opposite of happy. Mm-hmm. So, listeners, I got interested in this topic of happiness. There's two reasons I want to talk about happiness today. One is because Brian and I did a show a couple years ago. It was a really fun show. It was on the meaning of life. And we took different philosophical or lenses, like what does Confucius say about the meaning of life? What does Socrates say about the meaning of life? That kind of thing. And, you know, what is nihilism? What does that view of the meaning of life say? You know, that kind of thing. That was a fun show.
Sure.
And so I got interested in doing a show on the same kind of vibe, but looking at the meaning of happiness. What do different philosophers have? What have they said about the meaning of happiness? What do we think about this?
Meaning of happiness.
And yeah, you could come up with a little ditty or a little theme song as you just did.
Yeah, I'll work on that. Yeah, but in fact, he did not work on that.
That and I want to, because Brian, I have to be honest, when I was reading this article, mm-hmm. it seemed very shallow. The explanation of different philosophers' views of happiness seemed shallow to me. And really? I thought, really? Is that? That seems like a very simplistic view of what Aristotle thinks or a very simplistic view of Kant. But I'm not a philosopher. You are. So you got to help me out here. Okay?
I can help.
You got to help. Can you help?
Maybe.
Maybe.
We'll see.
Maybe. We'll see. Or he has to turn in his, you have to turn in your card-carrying philosopher. Ooh. You have to turn in your card.
Maybe. I can help with this, but before we go too far, let me go ahead and, I'm just looking at some research here to find some other schools. USC has last year.
University of Southern California?
Yeah, this year will have a $95,000 price tag for the upcoming year. Harvey Mudd College, $93,000. University of Chicago.
Gosh.
Just for a year.
How much?
$93,000.
Oh my gosh.
Wellesley, $92,600. University of Pennsylvania, $92,500. Amherst, $92,100. Tufts, $91,800. Northwestern, $91,000
a
year.
Now let me give you. Let me give you a little, let's put an asterisk on this, okay? I gotta tell you something, which by the way, if you all listening to Brian read that list, wondered if he has food in his mouth, let me tell you, he does, but it's Derby pie, and Derby is next week.
Yeah.
So Justin, will you give him a pass?
Well, and also I would just like to point out that if you're a cannibal, there's always food in my mouth.
Oh my God.
Right? I mean, am I right? As a mammal.
Justin told you that you eating... or either of us eating on air is a disaster, according to Justin.
He says that, but I think that increases the engagement.
Maybe, but because it's Derby pie and it's Derby season, yeah. I feel like in some ways you get a little bit of a pass.
Well, I would point out that Patty also has brownies that she would give me a pass if I eat one of those.
It's
too.
It's true because he eats my baked goods, and so I mean, gives me like props for my baked goods.
There you go. Yeah, so, anybody who wants brownies, you can get some from Patty.
Yeah. So anyway, the private schools know that, and I think this is true of a lot of the public, expensive public schools, they know that most families cannot afford full tuition. So what they do is they offer, like if you go to some of the websites of the schools that you mentioned, uh-huh. you will notice it will say either on the homepage or very, not too far into the websites, the financial aid or admissions, it will say something like, financial...
95% of admitted students right, get financial aid.
Right. Exactly like that. Because they don't want to discourage... Like, if you say, your kid's like, oh, I want to go to the school and it's $93,000, you know, you're as parents, you might say, well, forget, don't even apply. So what they don't want you to do is not apply. Okay, so that's one thing there. So they...
Because that's $93,000 missed.
So what they do is... what they do is they price it. Okay, so this is my very anecdotal as a parent, right? I don't work in financial aid and I do work in higher ed, but not in financial aid, but this is my very anecdotal view on it. So what they do is they price it really, really high, knowing that they're going to provide financial aid and scholarships.
Yeah.
So a chunk of that will come down. So they actually, oh, it's almost like going to the car dealership and the car is like priced at $30,000 because they know once they, this back in the day before when they would haggle with you, they would know, okay, this car, we're going to probably get $20,000, but we're going to price it at $30,000 and give ourselves some wiggle room.
Yeah.
So I feel like they price it high because then they give you financial aid and you're like, wow, we're getting a $93,000 education for only $60,000 a year. Wow, what a bargain. Which is still too outrageously expensive. Like, don't hear me saying that I think $60,000 is reasonable. I'm not saying that.
It's okay. U of L is like 12 or 13, isn't it? Something.
So U of L is, yeah.
Hey, look, I just wanted to point out that tuition and fees at U of L last year, $12,600. I mean, you still got to find a place to live on top of that. That might get pricey, but, you know, that's in-state. And for that price, you know, Larry used to say, U of L's a pretty good school. I think it's a pretty good school. For everyone.
And I just need you to edit out that whole last 5 minutes.
You don't want to talk about universities?
No. What I do? This is not the show topic.
Well, because it's a lot of money if it's not going to lead to your long term happiness.
Oh, I see. That's where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's just all agree higher ed is way too expensive.
Well,
It should not make students go into lifelong debt to pay for a college education.
I mean, the American experience is certainly one that is full of cost.
So that's one reason I want to talk about the meaning of happiness.
All right.
The other reason is because your birthday is coming up.
Oh, man. Talk about things we don't want to talk about.
And... We have a tradition of checking in on the level of Brian's happiness every year around his birthday because we're charting Brian's happiness against the research-based happiness curve, which we're going to talk about in a minute, but just as a quick summary, it's a U-shaped curve which... aggregates reports of life satisfaction so that you can see where over the span of a typical adult, where like happiness craters, like where it's the highest and then where it craters on the U and then where it goes back up. And we discovered back when Brian was turning 49.
A wee lad.
Yeah, Brian is now about to turn 51, or 50 wonderful, as I like to say.
Isn't that right?
Is that you were at the bottom of the happiness curve, or you, according to the research, you should have been at near the bottom. That was also, I might add, 2020. Yeah, that's right. It was near your late 40s, 2020, right around the time COVID was hitting.
Yeah.
And, this particular one actually shows it craters, this one craters like right at 50 or so.
Ugh.
So tell us, Right, and then it goes back up. So it comes down around, and then around 50, then happiness starts to curve back up.
Oh, man, fingers crossed.
So give us how the last 3 or 4 years have been for you. Has your happiness, like, been on the decline as the chart would suggest?
I mean, a lot of the things that I used to think about in terms of happiness have been on the decline. But I don't know that that means my overall happiness is on the decline.
Really? Say more.
Just different parts of my life, health things and financial things and various projects have been in decline, I suppose, in a mild way for a little while. But I anticipate them, you know, all bouncing back to improvement. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess that's what the curve says.
That's what the curve says.
Yeah. So if you have, I wasn't cheating. I was just thinking about
it. So if you felt the decline, that actually mirrors what the research says.
Yeah.
And that life is going to actually, according to the research, you're going to feel an incline on in happiness curve going up for you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
In your 50s. How do you feel about that?
That'd be great.
Would you like that?
I think that would be good for any of us.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, one question we have to look at, and I don't know what this particular source thinks about it, but, you know, what do we mean by happiness?
Well, according to this chart.
Where is this chart from?
This chart is this chart, there's many different versions of this chart. This one was, I lifted for today, was from a recent article called Happiness by Age, Stay Away from 35 to 60-Year-Olds, from Financial Samurai. That's the name of this guy. He runs this author is appearing in this website, Slicing Through Money's Mysteries. That's the website.
All right.
And so they're citing this survey from Nielsen. It's a Nielsen survey.
Uh-huh.
But you and I had looked at surveys. Actually, they had done this happiness survey across several, like a global survey, and they found that it mirrored. They actually have a chart here that shows in some countries, it's not exactly the same kind of curve, but you see a dip in China, Russia, United Kingdom. Russia, the dip comes like a little bit later. Germany,
doesn't seem to go back up in Russia.
Yeah, in Russia, that's sad. Yeah, the Russia one, it seems to like really stay down.
Yeah.
But the other ones, they have a pretty dramatic curve up. And this one, yeah. So that's really interesting. And so one of the things that they're finding is that health is a big factor.
Sure.
Okay.
Imagine.
Right. And they're also finding that money is not necessarily a indicator.
Well, it all depends on your point of view, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And what country you're in.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they said, this one was really interesting, they said parenthood. And when you zoom in and you look at parenthood, the lowest happiness point for parents is when their children, teenagers, are between 12 and 16. And look, when their children leave, emptiness, look at it. Look at that zooming up. And I got to admit, true for me.
Is that right? Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but true for me.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm thinking that your happiness pattern is going to follow the research, and you're going to find your 50s, it's going to be like zooming up.
Woo! Double-decker cardboard box for me.
So... yeah. I want to report back next year.
We will continue to report back.
What are you
back.
Looking forward to in your next in your 51st year?
Looking for some just looking for some long-term projects to come together. I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, I've got some academic stuff I've been working on. I've got some, you know, financial stuff, relationship stuff. It'd just be nice if some of these things started coming together on their long curve.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you've got some things that are in flux and you want them to kind of come together in, in the way that you're envisioning.
That'd be great.
Okay.
What about for you? How's your happiness? What does it say about your happiness?
Well, according to me and my 58th year, it should be pretty high.
Okay. They don't differentiate between gender expressions or anything like that?
I would say my happiness curve is pretty high.
Okay.
I feel like I have a lot more leisure now than I have had. I'm trying to remember the last time I had this much leisure. Because I went right from grad school to working and being a parent of small children. So I didn't really have a lot of leisure in my late 20s and 30s.
Okay.
Or so in my 40s. So I'm like, wow, I have so much leisure now. It's really nice.
That's great.
It's really nice.
Maximize.
Yeah. So I'm really enjoying that part.
Good for you.
So.
Well, you know, I don't think we're looking at the World Happiness Report. Did you look at that?
What do you mean? We were looking at it.
We did?
Yeah. The World Happiness Report?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just came out this year.
Oh, we were just looking at this chart.
But like the World Happiness Report comes out every 5 years. We got one for 2024 that just came out.
Oh, no. We need to look at that. No.
Let's see.
I thought we were going to look at this meaning of happiness.
Well, we can.
Oh, look at this World Happiness Report. Oh, I'm so intrigued now that you put this in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you hear about this?
You know, if you keep up with happiness, it's there in the zeitgeist.
You keep up with happiness?
Well, it's an alternative indicator to things like GDP.
Huh.
A lot of people want to say, even economists in a lot of cases want to say that what we ought to be measuring is something other than just economic indicators.
Yeah.
We ought to be trying to find a way to measure actual happiness for people.
Wow, this is really cool.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's do, maybe we do part two and we take a deeper dive and have time to read this.
Oh, sure. I mean, I just think it's something for people to know that it's out there.
Yeah, that it's out there. World Happiness Dot report.
And what they say, what's interesting is in part of it that I looked at, it says that younger people overall, because they do this every 5 years, the trend has been typically that younger people are happier than older people around the world. In this case, younger people are less happy than they have been, but still seem to be around the world, but still seem to be happier overall than older folks, according to their measures. I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting way to look at the indicators.
Wow, this looks fascinating. Yeah. This looks really fascinating. Okay. So, this would be fun. All right. So, folks, if you're interested in learning more, worldhappiness.report. Wow. Okay. All right. Well, I would be very interested in that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's one of the interesting things I thought was that it shows the U.S. Being 24th, and in last time it came out, Finland was number one. Finland's still number one. All the Nordic countries are in the top 10.
Wow.
Germany and the U.S. both fell to 23 and 24, respectively.
Wow, the Nordic countries.
Yeah, they're often considered to be high.
I know. I did know that. They have, like, great social structure support and social services. And
I guess.
So, FICA.
FICA, yeah.
They enjoy FICA.
I suppose that's probably the...
They enjoy coffee and cake, right?
Yeah. I heard something about people in Finland drink more coffee per capita than anybody else.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that tracks.
It's cold and dark.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, what I'd like to talk about is what philosophers say about it. So I'd like to start with, first of all, when we say the meaning of happiness in philosophy, so like what do we mean by the term happiness?
Yeah.
So I was doing a little research for the show and I came across this article by who's a this person is a philosopher, and I think the name you say, Wei Zhang. You
got me.
I think X-I-A-N-G,
okay.
Maybe. Excuse me. And so,
my Romanized Chinese is weak.
Wei was talking about, when we talk about happiness, do we say, what is the difference between happiness and pleasure?
Right.
And so they said in philosophy, that's an important distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. So tell me if I'm portraying this accurately. So this idea that pleasure is something that might be pleasurable or enjoyable, you might experience something that way, yeah. But it's like a surface, maybe shallow experience, whereas happiness in this philosophical sense is more of a deeper, meaningful kind of experience. So it's like pleasure versus happiness.
Mm. Could be.
Depth versus just like a momentary, I don't know. What do you think?
I wouldn't think about it. I mean, I guess you could think about it in that way. I guess I'm thinking of instances where one might experience something that they might call a very deep pleasure, like an important intellectual insight that they've worked toward for years or something like that. I mean, the pleasure that comes along with finally reaching that understanding that you've been seeking, or maybe coming up with a new discovery in some area of inquiry. That could be pretty deep, but I think that the distinction, the way I think of the distinction, is between momentary pleasure. So it's pleasure that really is confined to the present moment, right? As opposed to long-term pleasure, which could manifest as a way of, as an aspect of my life, right?
Oh.
So,
right.
Yeah, because I mean,
something we would call like a quality of life thing.
Yeah, because I think that I can have a lot of episodic instances of pleasure, and they can be very high quality, and they might even be, in a lot of cases, especially if they're connected with other kinds of inquiries, we might be able to call them deep, right? Or even significant or something. But you could also have a life that has so much just bad stuff in it, right? So many negative impacts, as it were, that all of those positive instances, even the ones that are relatively significant, don't add up to happiness over the long term. So I think that's the way that I always think about it in philosophy, is there's momentary happiness, which can be a goal, right? And then there's this long-term kind of state of happiness. The ye old Aristotle referred to it as eudaimonia.
Oh, yeah. We were going to talk about that.
Yeah,
okay. So hold that thought.
Sure.
Hold that thought.
I tried
eudaimonia.
To.
Eudaimonia. I want to stay on this just for a moment, because the idea, when we talk about Aristotle's idea of happiness, or other, you know, John Stuart Mill's idea of happiness, or things like that, it pushes us to go beyond the shallow happiness barometers in our society around things like acquiring a bigger house or a nice car or a fancy this or that, which often in our culture, like that, oh, happiness is when I can, you know, buy a house in this zip code, or, you know, that tends to be a very shallow way that we think of the American dream. I feel like we think of the American dream as like acquiring.
Yeah, but the problem for me is, when I think about that, I mean, I agree with you, but I also see that if people aren't very self-reflective about what constitutes their happiness, I think it's easy for a lot of people to kind of buy into the societal markers for happiness, and for a very, very long time, they would self-report that they are happy, that they are living a happy life, that they are crushing it,
even if maybe at some point down the line, some of that, what they thought they were really getting, ends up being fake or illusory or somehow shallow.
Yeah,
you know.
Or sort of surface, like a surface pleasure, but underneath. I was researching this for this show. I saw something that said the two things that people come to see as most central to happiness and reporting is health and relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, the quality of their relationships with their friends, with their partners, with their family, with their coworkers or the people around them, and their health, like those two things. So that all of these other things that I might have, a pretty view or a nice vacation, that's these pleasures, but they're not this deep satisfaction or happiness.
Well, and I think, so I would say something like, maybe I go on vacation and I just have a transformational experience because I'm in a culture that offers me so many insights into my own living and ways toward positive change. I mean, that I would say that's still deep and that would be ongoing, even though all of those pleasures as I experience them might be episodically or individually shallow.
Okay. To your point, that's a great point. I should amend what I said about vacation. A vacation.
All I ever wanted, vacation.
Opportunity, if you're self-aware and present and mindful, a vacation can be really transformational experience.
Well, also sometimes just the place and the things. I mean, even, I mean, sometimes you get snapped out of your boredom.
You can come,
it isn't you at all. It's the thing.
You can come to some really deep insights.
Yeah.
In that, by moving out of your routine.
Yep.
And so I shouldn't just dismiss vacation as being...
I mean, a lot of it's shallow, as I understand it. I don't do a lot of vacation, but, you know, I mean...
Well, it can be, though. I mean, it's just like what I said about relationships. Right. You can have shallow relationships, or you can have meaningful relationships.
Sure, but remember, if we're talking about happiness, sometimes... this is the distinction, I think, right, that we're talking about, is that sometimes the individual instances of happiness can be very profound, even though in the large scheme they might be shallow or unconnected or just kind of this one-off thing, right? And other times that same kind of combination is like an epiphany. Mm-hmm. At least, you know, so I mean, I think that, you know, we can talk about it easily in terms of a long-term character of happiness or posture of happiness or life of happiness or something, and then also talk about it as individual pieces of happiness. And in both cases, I would say we could say that they're shallow or deep. depending on the instance. Yeah. But I just want to, I don't want to characterize it necessarily as shallow or deep. I want to characterize it as long lasting or brief.
Interesting.
Okay. Because that's where, because a lot of times when philosophy, as I'm sure you're going to mention in a moment, I mean, a lot of times philosophy, classically, the stuff is talked about in terms of hedonism, right? And so hedonism is a pursuit of pleasure, and in its highest form, it's constantly trying to keep pleasure. It doesn't appreciate the downtime, so it's always trying to stay in this pleasurable moment. That'll lead to a disaster. Like, over the course of a life, just pursuing hedonism tends to lead to really bad lives, but they're loaded with individual instances of pleasure.
I see what you're saying. Right.
Yeah.
So in both cases, though, part of what you're talking about is being mindful. And not
So
let's talk about Aristotle, since you mentioned eudaimonian.
That's how eudaimonia. You
say? Okay, so let's look at what different philosophers have to say. Okay?
Let's look at them.
Ready? Here's a quote from Aristotle.
Philosophers are mostly down on happiness, but not Aristotle necessarily. Aristotle digs mostly down on, and that's my experience of philosophy, is that this is really some weak stuff, Barnes. That's what you're into. Got it.
Happiness depends on ourselves, okay? That's what the quote here from, by the way, this article is called Secrets for a Happy Life, According to History's Greatest Philosophers, which I'm like, okay. Mm. Aristotle followed Plato's path. He believed that every individual pursues happiness.
What did he do?
I know.
Oh, my God. I'm sorry. I just had a little thing happen
in
my mind.
I shouldn't have said that.
All right. Anyway.
I was coming out of my mouth. I'm like, He believed that every individual pursues happiness and that happiness lies in self-realization.
Okay, yeah.
Some are happy earning money, others receiving awards and titles, others traveling. Uh-huh. Each individual possesses a unique reason for happiness. And in order to find our own, we need to look within ourselves. We need to practice self-realization.
Oh, wow. This is the shallowest reading of Aristotle I've heard in a minute. But, I mean, carry on.
I know. That's what I told. I told you, didn't I tell you? I thought these were shallow and I needed your help.
I mean, maybe, you know, I mean, that's definitely a way to read Aristotle. I just think it's sort of like you went the topic sentence of each paragraph and just put them all together and made an essay.
It says, but there's a catch. Identifying what truly makes you happy can be petrifying. Why? Because you might realize that you've been on the wrong course for a while. What if your efforts have been in vain?
Or you never realize
what if you've done all of this for nothing?
And you just screw it up.
It's a hard thing to admit. What if you need to start over? It's petrifying. I was one of the people who came to this realization this year that I was on the wrong path. Wait a minute.
Somebody had a tough year and decided to write an article about it. Is this somebody's blog? It's like Patty grabbed some journal from a table at a bookstore.
Okay.
I was having a tough year. I was thinking, I don't know if I'm very happy. I'm doing all these things. Let's see what Aristotle has to say.
Okay.
This really turned me around.
Okay. All right. Okay. I admit.
Patty's looking around the room like, maybe I brought the wrong article. She's flipping through all of her papers.
I did.
No. I'm sure there's something there that's
Aristotle.
Valuable. Here's the thing about Aristotle, in case anybody's curious. We could pull the volume of Aristotle off the wall if we want. But mainly, mainly for Aristotle, he says that happiness is this goal that is involved in all of our other goals. That Aristotle thinks that when we attempt to do something, we're attempting to do that because somewhere consciously or unconsciously, we believe that that will make us happy. So this is why there's personal responsibility tied up with all these instances of happiness, because I choose the intermediate goal. What do I want to do? I want to learn to make a vase out of clay. I want to learn to power walk. I want to learn to, send email to my grandkids. I want to learn to knit. Whatever this thing might be, it's a way for me to achieve happiness. And so Aristotle thinks that every time I make free choices about what I want to do, particularly with my reason, I'm going to be choosing something that I believe is going to provide happiness for me over the long term. That's why I do everything that I do. And of course, some of us are wrong, right? But that's so, I mean, happiness is core for him. And the best life, even though those other lives are mentioned, they're all substandard in Aristotle to the life of contemplation, of course, as you might imagine from philosopher types,
But all of those lives, the way they get judged at the end is, can I look back on this and say that overall I had a happy life, which is to say that I hit the target of happiness, in my view, more often than not. For Aristotle, that's the best life you can have. Like, it doesn't matter how you achieve that. It's that if we go back and we ask ourselves, what would the best outcome be for human beings? Like, what would the best kind of life be for any human being? For Aristotle, it's one where you can look back on it and say, I was happy. Because like what? Like, you were wealthy but not happy? You were famous but not happy? You had all these lovers but you weren't happy? Bunch of kids, not happy? Big house, not happy? I mean, the happiness part is what really makes it, you know, a life that is worth pursuing for Aristotle. And that's, he thinks we're all doing that somehow, you know, in our motives.
So happiness is the ultimate goal in life?
Ultimate goal.
Okay, according to Aristotle.
That's eudaimonia. That's a state of consistent happiness over life.
Okay. But how does he say we get there?
Well, that's tough. I mean, the way that we get there, of course, is self-reflectively. We have to set up, we have to learn about the systems that make happiness in the place that we live, what would lead to happy outcomes for a person living here. And then we make conscious choices about how to pursue those. And he has a system for that, essentially, that, you know, we identify what these characteristics would be for me to live a happy life. And then I try to keep those in balance.
Have you ever tried that? Have you ever tried Aristotle's method?
Every day.
And? How do you do?
Well, you know, it brings me to my favorite Aristotle quote.
What?
It's no easy task to be good.
That's your favorite quote. It's no easy task to be good.
I think it's damn hard. But and Aristotle thought it was hard.
Does he think you should keep doing it?
He thinks that overall you're going to get that happy life if you put in that work and if your analysis was correct. Okay. Right? But the problem is that for us to stay balanced with all these characteristics that we set up for ourselves, that means literally for Aristotle that sometimes you give up short-term pleasure for long-term positive whatever leading to pleasure, right? So a lot of times we don't do that well.
Yeah, no, we don't.
Yeah, a lot of times we just blow that. We're like, right. Well, okay, I'm, you know, I wasn't going to take this short-term pleasure, but here I am. And so what that does is that puts me in an area that takes me out of balance. I mean, I could be a lot more technical, but nobody cares. Yeah. So it takes us out of balance with that system. And for Aristotle, really, what happens is over time, we develop a character, right? I develop a way of thinking about things and a way of doing things in these environments in which I interact all the time.
Right.
So that's my character. And if I keep things out of balance all the time, for Aristotle, it's harder for me to live a good life.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
It's just
right.
It's because if I'm out of balance, what that really means is there's friction between me and the systems of society and the citizens with whom I'm living. That creates the friction. And so that, it makes life harder, literally, in all kinds of ways, just depending on what it is.
Okay. Aristotle. Eudaimonium. Okay. So what about Buddha?
Aristotle didn't have anything to say about the historical Buddha.
What did Buddha have to say about happiness? I mean, is it just non-attachment? Man. Is it non-attachment? Is that the whole thing?
Happiness is a trap for Buddha, for the historical Buddha. I mean, all life is suffering, but suffering is caused by desire. And so we mistake long-term happiness for short-term desire. For the historical Buddha, I think... I say that as if I know. You know, my understanding of that system is just that, you know, over time, I pursue things that lead to my long-term satisfaction, but I have to have discernment. I need to figure out what those things are and what's worthy of my pursuit and what's not. And for the historical Buddha, you wouldn't really look to society for that because society is mostly wrong about values, because society mostly is not embracing, for example, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path,
the various other mechanisms of achieving.
Wow.
Ultimately, for Buddhism, I mean, if we're going for the gold in Buddhism, it's the obliteration of the self. That's not usually what people are going for,
no.
right? So,
no.
I mean, for both, I think, classical Hinduism and classical Buddhism, you have to get to...
Like transcend your own ego.
Exactly.
Like, right?
Well, and you transcend all of this kind of human experience. And that, in order, the way to get there, for the most part, is through a lot of dedicated inner work. Which, you know, unless you've already achieved a lot of satisfaction from it, is often quite boring and not nearly as interesting as a lot of other things you might do with yourself. But the insights that you achieve after 5, 6, 10 hours of meditation, I mean, those are profound. But who the hell wants to sit there? Like, most of us are just like, ah. And so what happens is I get bored with the mechanism.
Right.
I get distracted by lots of other things. I should go do the dishes. This is stupid. 4 hours is enough. Why would I do another hour? You know, kind of thing. So I need to go do these other things. And so what I'm doing is I'm buying into this illusory world instead of focusing on the reality of kind of the cosmic metaphysics, if you will. And that's why I get reincarnated back as another dude. That's why I can't break free. So happiness, in the sense that we often think of it in the Greek context, I mean, the everyday kind of way of, you know, episodic happiness, it's a trap for classical Buddhism.
Wow.
And but of course you're going to be happy long term if you do the path toward enlightenment right. That's a long term, deeply held happiness, but it's almost like it's almost the wrong term. It's almost even a category mistake. Like, they're going to say, that's not what we mean. Like, you and I can't recognize that kind of happiness in what we do.
Because happiness, right, because that, again, feels like that's an ego thing, right? Like,
the ego makes it really hard. Yeah.
Like,
and, of course, if we're overcoming the ego, the biggest danger to that is being proud that I'm doing it, right? I mean, then I'm just, like, back in the toilet again. So,
okay. Yeah. All right, what do you think about this one, this quote? From Nietzsche.
Oh, man. Tell me.
Okay, you ready?
Yeah, sure.
You ready for this?
Talk about a guy who wasn't very happy.
Happiness is the feeling that power increases, that resistance is being overcome. What?
I don't know. I don't know where that's from.
Know.
I don't know what that was taken
this
out
says,
of.
It says most of the time we're the biggest barrier to our own happiness. We create problems that aren't there. Even when we're faced with external forces, it's our internal interpretations of those forces that lead us to feel unhappy.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like they probably took that section out of the business about the Übermensch.
Yeah.
You know, which is a person who overcomes conventional morality and establishes their own morality. And that person then, you know, ultimately, you know, lives by their own rules, right? Their own rules of morality that they've established. And that, for Nietzsche, is supposed to create kind of this abiding happiness, particularly when I'm successful, because ultimately I have to try to overcome others. There's a strong competitive aspect to this that I think you have to study a lot of Nietzsche as opposed to having one sentence of Nietzsche. I think you have to study a lot of Nietzsche to actually know what Nietzsche was talking about. A lot of people boil him down into like the most simplistic stuff, and I've always just found that there's just a huge amount of complexity there. And so anytime anything comes up with Nietzsche, I'm afraid I'm back at the restaurant bar after work circa 1994 with my master's degree in philosophy, and the line cook over here is telling me he was just reading some Nietzsche and he wanted to tell me what it's all about. And I just find that it's too difficult to have these conversations with people who've only read a chapter or a couple of lines.
Or one line.
Because that line, I mean, I think I know the context, but frankly, it could be pulled from a lot of different sources. I mean, I got two Nietzsches right here.
You do.
It could come out of either one of those.
You do.
Yeah, I mean, it could come out a lot of stuff. So I don't know. But I do think that's one way to look at Nietzsche.
Okay.
So.
Now, what about utilitarianism?
All about long-term pleasure.
What? It is?
Sure.
I thought utilitarian. Okay, is that John Stuart Mill?
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, Mill is the second generation.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who was the first generation?
Jeremy Bentham is his teacher.
Jeremy Bentham, the one who's...
The auto icon.
The one who's preserved himself.
Yeah, his body is in King's College.
Yes.
What's the use of a dead philosopher?
Yeah.
Many people may ask that about me. I don't know.
Utilitarianism. My question is... My understanding of that is happiness is the greater good?
Well, the problem is that utility is this word that can mean happiness in 18th century language, but it really just refers to benefit. So any kind of benefit. It doesn't have to be happiness. Like, I don't have to feel happiness to get benefit.
Right.
So utility is about benefit, but it's often translated as pleasure. Or even as happiness. And I think that's where you get a lot of conflated notions. You know, the thing for utilitarianism is it focuses on my lived experience of being a creature with a nervous system, right? So naturally, for utilitarianism, all of us gravitate toward pleasurable activities of all types, and we recoil from painful things, right? Mm-hmm. And try not to repeat those. So for the utilitarian, I'm focused on the way that people experience individual pleasure broadly understood, right? Not just physical, but mental and social, right? And financial and spiritual and all of that. Broadly understood. But then what I'm actually trying to do in every situation is I'm trying to create, to the extent that there's more than one person involved, I'm trying to create the greatest aggregate amount of benefit for the individuals in the situation. So
the greatest number, greatest good for the greatest number?
Right. So I only look at individual pleasures to the extent that they will aggregate into the larger group, and then you lose the individual focus.
I see.
But what a lot of people do is they take utilitarianism and they just turn it into some very complicated, like, ethical egoism. Like, I'm just interested in my own subjective benefit. But, the utilitarians are pretty clear. You don't use utilitarianism for yourself. It's not useful, really. It's for groups. It's for the benefit of the whole, for the society. And in your long-term life... For Mill, anyway, one of the big problems is what kinds of activities would be the most pleasurable to create aggregate happiness in, like, a group. And so that's where, for him, he wants to point to things like higher pleasures, because he's saying, if I develop more complex and more sort of culturally valuable ability to have pleasure, then what that does is that creates for me a larger capacity for pleasure in the long term. And that means when we get into the aggregation, right, there's more pleasure available for me to avail myself of and for the group. So all of us should be increasing our personal capacity for pleasure, because then that makes more pleasure available for group aggregation. But for him, primarily the way to get to that is through mental pleasure. Right? Because physical pleasure is limited, he thinks. But mental pleasure is one of the things that makes us uniquely human. And so you want to maximize that and get other people to do it too. And then you'll have, I mean, there's kind of a utopian feel to Mill's long-term goals there. And for Bentham too.
Well, wow. I was not expecting that.
Not prepared for so much happiness?
I was not prepared for so much happiness. But you haven't said your personal definition. We have to each say something about our personal definition.
Well, I do think that it's important to pursue happiness in the long term. I mean, Aristotle and the utilitarians would be, I think, in line with this particular idea that long term, short term happiness is only so useful. I mean, it can be great, but it's not going to be... it's not going to convey the sense of overall satisfaction with life, right? So we have to find ways to maximize, I think,
our overall sense of happiness, which is complicated. And sometimes we look to the culture, and sometimes I look to individual experiences, and sometimes there are maybe other ways of approaching it. But I think that, you know, for me anyway, the long term, the overall arc of human happiness, you know, is probably the way that I tend to look at this for myself.
That's pretty philosophical of you.
Weird, huh?
For a philosopher.
Yeah. How about for you?
I tend to look at happiness, I feel like, in terms of things like connection and balance, and I like to engage and be involved with activities that foster connection between, like, my work is very much about connecting people or ideas in an organization, or elevating work that's being done, personal development and professional development. So okay. I very much like that idea of constant improvement and growth, and the idea of being part of, like, I got into this work because when I was a graduate student, I realized, well, I could teach and I could just improve teaching in my own classroom, or I could have a job where I help improve the system as a whole. And for me, that brings a lot of happiness when I can contribute and help a system and help bigger systems improve. And I don't know. That's something that's important to me.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty interesting stuff. I mean, sounds like you have a long-term sense of happiness as well. It sounds like you're not just focused on moments, even though these are made up of moments.
Yeah. But at the same time, like everyone else, I think I have my own personal things that make me happy. And I don't like, as like the older I get, the less I like a lot of activity. Like I don't like to fill up my calendar with a million things.
Oh, I see. So part of your happiness is, it's kind of like the space between the notes, like maybe, that's the way I think of it. You know, when I was...
White space on my calendar. Yeah.
When I was younger, I used to think a lot about the focal point, getting the activity done, acquiring the thing, putting the thing in the right place, making these combinations. Like you're talking, like a lot of these individual things are very much my focus. And what I find I really crave a lot now is that sense of space.
Yes.
There's air there. There's not a big rush with it. It's not a, it's not a crisis.
Right.
You know, those
I'm
things,
not interceding to save the world, in 5 minutes.
Oh, man.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm
for whatever you get out of that, that's a lot of work.
So I just, the older I get, I like that that time and that, like, space and without feeling rushed and hurried. But that's hard sometimes.
It's hard sometimes because we're told for sure that the goals that we should be achieving vis-a-vis happiness are right in front of us. I mean, the culture is very clear about that, I think. You know, that we should be acquiring things in front of us.
Oh, yeah, and the shiny new thing, shiny this thing.
Whatever it is, just different thing.
Yeah.
I think that there's a lot of push that direction. It makes it hard.
So, and I really like this focus, this idea about health and relationships. Like, how can we really, really enjoy those things in our lives, those really bring deep satisfaction?
You know, they do. And we hope that you will find some ways to cultivate your deep satisfaction and your happiness, however you define it, in the coming week. Because like thinking about your thinking, happiness is probably forever.
Even you.